Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to Work is Weird Now. Today's guest is Richard Hubbard. Richard is a business incubator consultant, having served long tenures as CMO at ISG and Director of Marketing for Cambridge University, to name a few. Today, now in his mid-50s, he finds himself grappling with the next steps. He's currently starting up a new business venture. In today's episode, we're taking a different angle to Work as Weird Now. We're shining the light on Richard's career, reflecting on the twists and turns of his journey, how he navigated midlife, and what advice he'd give to anybody facing a mid-career juncture. We're also going to find out what the next chapter in his career is shaping up to look like. We kick off every episode with what is your weird work moment of the week. Alice, what was yours?
My weird work moment of the week this week was that I was ghosted by a client that I've been speaking to over the last couple of months. And despite the fact that I've been doing this for quite a long time and have got used to the occasions where after many conversations, suddenly people go quiet for very extended periods of time, if not forever, I think the sting of it never quite leaves. And I always believe that even though I prepare myself for the potential eventuality of being ghosted, it still feels harsh when it happens.
Yeah, from ghosting and dating to ghosting and work is
exactly
tricky to swallow on both sides of the fence. My work weird work moment, I joined my first ever round table. Now, as a marketer, it's normally my role to set them up or secure my stakeholders onto round tables, etc. But I actually got the call up and it was really, really great event. And I was in the room with lots of industry peers. And I expected to walk away having learned tons, and I didn't. That's not a bad thing. And it actually gave me real reassurance that I wasn't missing anything. And I think I went in there almost a little bit of imposter syndrome, but I got lots out of it in terms of really great networking and just sharing some of the challenges that other marketers have and how we overcome them together. And that was really insightful. Richard, what was yours?
So I think mine, as you know, I kind of considered retirement recently, but have decided to do some consultancy work as part of a business incubator. And I had my first delivery as an individual. You know, the first thing I actually got over the line, had to present back to a client. And Alice, I know this has been your world for a long time, but it's not been my world. And so I felt nerves for the first time, proper nerves in a different way. It was a real reminder of that old 80s cliche, feel the fear and do it anyway, because it went well. And the high that I felt afterwards, yeah, my dog got a really good walk afterwards. But that felt.
Yeah, you really, really can't beat that feeling, can you?
Yeah, yeah.
Love that. Yeah, I really love that. And I just think it goes to show that no matter what stage in your career, seniority, like whatever it may be, nerves are real. It shows you're really human, and just the thrill of the win almost is still as, the stakes are still as high.
And it's, you're pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, which is good. We should continue to do that throughout our careers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that will be a topic we'll touch on, because my whole career has been about pushing myself out of my comfort zone. You know,
really. Don't even know where the comfort zone is at this point.
No, I'm not sure I ever quite found it. but that whatever success I've had has been as a result of really taking risks. Yeah.
I think that's a good segue into the other question we asked at the beginning of the episode, which is, are you where you thought you'd be at this point in your career? And if not, why?
Depends at what stage of my life you're asking. I'm 56. What will life be? At 21, 56 seemed impossibly old, and I would have had absolutely no idea. I guess as I hit 50, and in my early 50s, I had, you know, a health blip and things like that, and they make you reconsider things. And I actually thought I would be retiring earlier than I did in the end, about, you know, a few years earlier than I did. But for various reasons, I kept going. Am I where I thought I would be? No, because I thought I would be retiring and traveling the world, and instead I'm working and I've got a new puppy. So no, I'm not where I thought I'd be, but I'm pretty happy, pretty content with where I am.
That's great. So I just want to start out with hitting you with a stat, because I read this week and it was surprising. Well, it was surprising and not surprising in some ways, but I'd be really interested to get your perspective on it. So this is a survey from the Center for Aging Better as part of its Age Without Limits campaign. And they interviewed thousands of people and found that a quarter of those people felt that hiring workers over 50 was not a smart business decision. And in particular, cited concerns about older employees being slower and less adaptable. And my question is, how do you feel these days? Do you feel like that's a valid complaint? Or do you believe that what you do have to offer counteracts potentially what you might feel you're missing at this stage of your career?
It's a real trade-off, isn't it? I'm not sure there's a simple answer to it. I mean, I have experience that I think is valuable that you can't get easily in your younger years, you know, and I think that will remain valuable. But I get it. I get that people would think that way. Am I less adaptable? Probably yes. I have consciously made an effort in all aspects of my life that I won't stand still. I don't have a period of music that I'm attached to. I still look out for Band of the Week in The Guardian, that column, and I try new music every week. It's really important to me. And so I'd like to think it's not so true of me that I'm not adaptable. But it would certainly be true that I think I found recipes for success that I stick to. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably fairly difficult to dissuade from those because they've worked for me. And in a way, it's the simple stuff, you know. Technology changes, the gig economy has come along, you know, but work is weird. But actually, the principles that sit behind that, I think, pretty much don't change. Mm. And, you know, all the stuff about, you know, it's really how you make people feel in the process of marketing that makes the difference. That remains true. The channels through which you do it and the new ways of doing it are almost, they've always changed and they will continue to change. So I don't know. I don't think I'm ready to be put out to pasture yet, but if a quarter of people do, I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Right. So if we go back in time then to your 20s, when you look back on that period, because from what I understand, you had quite a rapid ascension into leadership during that stage. Looking back on it, do you feel like you were prepared for that? And what is your impression when you look back on yourself as a leader at that stage?
Yes. Yeah, so I started out as a journalist. That is a very selfish solo journey. And back then it was dialing in stories from payphones. Then fairly quickly, I started to get into PR, marketing communications. And then that is when suddenly, you know, I had a boss that was having a baby and I was asked to step up and do that role. Was I equipped? Well, I had no training. I was probably put on a course. Can't remember, but I'm sure I was put on some kind of numpty management course at the time. But I think that I was ambitious for whatever reason. I have no idea where that's come from. It was like, I might fail at this. This could be a disaster, but if I'm going to be paid a little bit better and it's going to make my work a little bit more interesting, I'm going to give it a go. And I'd like to think that that fairly rapid ascension was because actually back then, well, I think I've always valued people. You know, I think I've always acted with kindness as a manager, and that's how you get the best out of people. And I didn't have a rule book back then, and I had a really supportive, inspiring manager. And she taught me a lot just by watching her and kind of moved my desk onto the end of her desk, a bit like a dominoes piece, and was constantly giving me tips and making me laugh, which always helped. So that was kind of the start of it, and it went well, and that ascension was pretty rapid. I probably had a team of 10 by the time I was 23, and they would have all been pretty much old, all have been older than me. Some people at 50s, you know, my kind of age.
Were there some hard lessons you learned about management at that time?
I think the hardest thing is when you have to do the hardest thing, which is let people go. And when you are doing that as a young manager, to people that are older, and you have this principle of kindness, so you inevitably let it overrun. But you know it's the right thing for them. And you know that all of your peers in the company are thinking, why haven't you done this yet? I'm probably a bit of a people pleaser. And I was probably worried about what the rest of the team might say and think of me. And that was really tough. It's that weight of responsibility when you're young. So I think I probably found that tough and probably took that home with me quite a lot at that age. It never gets easy, but it does get easier.
Do you find that you've been, over time, become better at separating that from your home life and kind of keeping those two things from blurring so much in terms of the paint? No, he's shaking his head.
No, yeah, I unfortunately, I think it's a pride thing, probably goes with the ambition thing. If I know I've screwed up, then that will eat me up. And it not just in my waking hours at home, but ends of my dreams. The only thing I would say is, I've got a few simple coping mechanisms that I've developed, such as, okay, there gets a cutoff point where I'm thinking, this is actually getting you nowhere now. It's not going to change anything that's happened. So just make your brain go white. Just think white screen for a bit. Probably recover quicker from failure. But it still stings and eats me up.
Right. So you started out in this early leadership role. When did you end up moving into the construction industry?
So about 18, 19 years ago. And it was quite a significant part in my career, because I spent the first half of my career in not-for-profit, in charities, and the second half of my career basically in construction and for-profit. So it's quite interesting to look at those two sides of the coin in a way, you know.
So as a people-pleasing, people-oriented person coming from the nonprofit world, how did you find that introduction into the what I would imagine was a much harsher world of construction?
Yeah, you would imagine that, wouldn't you? When I first came into construction, I was working in a partnership, so a consultancy. And partnerships are full of big personalities. You know, they have to be, because people have to earn their fee. And I found managing people's personalities sometimes quite difficult. But actually, It was a sort of Sunday Times top place to work. And what I found was that the rewards outstripped the downsides. You know, I spent my first week of being in the construction industry. I was taken to Lisbon to meet the other new starters. We were sent on a plane to Lisbon for a few days. I'm like, you know, imagine that happening in a council. You know, of course, they couldn't afford to do something like that. So I felt, in many ways, I felt spoiled. I didn't find it harsh, Alice, in answer to your question. And there are personalities and people that are easy to work with and people that are challenging to work with wherever you go. Mm-hmm. And also, I would say, in not-for-profits, very often they do a lot of things very thoroughly. So their people processes, you know, you kind of can't just decide you want somebody to go and make it happen the next day. You know, there will be a thorough audit trail of meetings and PDRs and appraisals and you know, that will be a very thorough process. That can happen in for-profits, but in my experience, less so. So there's a thoroughness that I've tried to take forward from my not-for-profit experience that into my for-profit. But I didn't find it harsher, and I didn't find construction harsh. My father was a plumber. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, so it's kind of, I was among my people, if you, you know, it wasn't. Yeah. I didn't struggle with that.
Okay. And then what did the next, so this sort of trajectory then through the construction part of your career, what did that look like?
Yeah. So I was an associate partner, as I say, as a sort of QSPM-based construction consultancy, as Quanti Surveying, project management-based construction consultancy, who were biggest or second biggest, maybe the most prestigious, arguably, in the UK, although they did work globally. And I was, as I say, associate partner, kind of sales and marketing, because by that time, sales and bids and that kind of thing had come into my role as well. And really the ambition at that stage was to become a full partner, and, you know, and then the dream would have been a full equity partner. It's one of my shortest tenures, because I was only there 3 years, which for me is not long. I know for a lot of marketing people that would be average or an eternity even, but wasn't the longest tenure, because they got bought out by a very large American consultancy with 75,000 people or so. And I didn't think that would be for me. Just felt like I would get lost. So the day the American consultancy picked up the keys was my last day at work. I'd already got another job. And that was when I went into contracting with a company called ISG. And I moved over there in a similar kind of role. I think it was like a head of sales and marketing, something like that. And the chief executive at the time put a lot of faith in me. And that really kind of kickstarted the rapid elevation. You know, and I think with your career, it kind of, you go in sharp ascensions, then you do a little bit of learning and flatlining almost. So you learn, but you don't, you make your mistakes and then you can go again kind of thing. And so that was a real stage where I'd learned a lot. I'd learned a lot about the construction industry coming from a consultancy who would have been a work giver to the main contractor, was probably seen as, oh, he's operated at a different level. So that gave me some kudos coming into a tier one contractor. And then things really did kind of skyrocket again from that.
I had a question on that, actually, because you know, you mentioned in our briefing call that you'd reached a career goal by 28, your original career goal. And did you, once you've done that, how do you almost reassess? Do you, is again, you set another one?
It's really interesting. I often joke with friends that there's an old UK comedy show, the Catherine Tate show, and she has and it's a sketch show, and she has a character who always says, "I could do that," and people, friends at the time, had said, it's you, you know, she's never equipped to do the things that she says she can do, but she don't, you know, she goes for anyone, always ends in disaster for her, but for me, it's generally been okay. You grow in confidence, don't you? And you prove to yourself, and after a while, that imposter syndrome, though it never goes away, you kind of think, okay, Richard, you've been doing this for 20 years now, and so I think by the time I was pushing 30, and I had a huge team, and I was working for a department of the university that had been between 50 and 70, maybe more, 75 people in my team at that stage. Everything from customer services to right through to mark comms and customer care and all sorts of things. And I went international at that stage as well. So I was traveling to Asia and Caribbean and Africa, all over the place for the university. So I also went through some personal stuff at that time. And I think that was... Yeah, I think what happened around that time, Dan, was I went through some personal stuff, and it was kind of, that was so challenging that anything at work kind of paled into insignificance. So that kind of, I can do that. It was, I had a reset, you know, and actually, in a way, I look back and think that personal stuff really stood me in good stead because it reset what I could tolerate. And what I could get through. And so work almost became like a refuge.
Like an outlet, yeah.
I worked with nice people. Mm. My brain was fully occupied, so I couldn't think about the other things that were going on. And I came through all of that, a tougher individual. So I probably got that to thank in a weird kind of way. And so that spurred me on. Because I think at that time in my personal life, I probably felt like a little bit of a failure. I damn well wasn't going to let it happen at work, you know? Mm. So I probably spurred me on, comes back to that pride I talked about at the beginning a little bit, you know, spurred me on to go again. And a lot of these things also I feel you fall into, or I don't mean false modesty, but you kind of, you know, sometimes you're just in the right place at the right time. Somebody resigns, somebody isn't working out, and you're the next best thing, you know. And there was quite a lot of that, to be honest.
Where do you think that, you've mentioned it a couple of times now, where do you think that pride comes from?
I think I was a very shy child. Didn't find the school environment was my place, probably. Grew up in Norfolk, went to a small kind of town, comprehensive, you know, I didn't have a, some of my education was private, but most of it, by the time I got to high school, I was at a comprehensive, and I didn't fit, probably. I'd have been better off in a big town in London or something like that. So I had a lot of friends, but I didn't find my tribe, probably, you know. So I think I probably came out of that with a point to prove. Didn't do massively well either. I didn't shine academically. And I think that's partly because the environment, you know, I just drifted, daydreamed a little bit, you know. I was good at art. That was kind of what I was good at. And so I came out of that kind of thinking I need to restore some pride. Yeah. People that I knew weren't as clever as me did way better. And so I did quite well in my A-levels and then went on to do quite well academically after that. So I think that's where it started, Alice. Yeah. And like I say, I feel the burn when I get something wrong. I wish I did.
I think a lot of us do.
Yeah, well, that helps. Thank you. So I think it stems from school. I think it would be fair to say my father was ambitious for me. Very different people, but he did well. I said earlier he was in the building trade and he built the house we lived in as well. He did very well. He changed to kind of financial services, and his career skyrocketed to the point where he was kind of number one in the country for the company he worked for at that time. I liked that. I was proud of him, quite liked that he'd done well. And I suppose I'd start to see what hard, he worked very hard. I started to see what hard work could get you. And probably, you know, that probably fueled me a little bit. But yeah.
So what you're describing there is really about status, right? So your dad was sort of achieving this status, and that was what made you proud. Was the status aspect important to you as you moved through your career?
At the beginning, I would say there came a point where I think genuinely I didn't mind what title I had. It was more about what I was getting to do and how it would affect things. At the beginning, you know, don't we all? You know, it's kind of like you're senior manager and you want to be a head for you. You know, you're an assistant manager and you want to be a manager. And it's kind of, I think it matters earlier in your career. By the end, when I'd kind of gotten to the C-suite thing, you know, people listening to this who know me might disagree, but genuinely to me, it was all about that meant in terms of what I could do, you know, how I could set culture, how I could make the place better, you know, how that's what became important, not the status. Actually was pretty heavy, you know.
Yeah, becomes a burden.
Yeah. Was that around midlife? Because just personally, you know, I was classic, wanted to be a marketing manager by this age, I wanted to be this by this age. And last year, there was a role that was on paper for me, was my dream role. It was down here in Brighton. You know, it had ticked all the boxes that I thought I needed for a job. And I was like, it's mine. It's going to be mine. They wouldn't interview me because I didn't have marketing director as a title. And normally I would have really felt that quite deeply. And my response back was, I've reported into C-suite directly for the past 8 years, you know, without a director above me. And eventually they interviewed me and I didn't get the role, and I'm relieved, actually. But it really, on reflection, you know, I've just taken head of role now. I'm reporting into CEO again. The title thing really isn't an issue. I'm really thriving and happy and content, all those things, by the work that I'm working on being fulfilling. And you know, the impact. And that's, I'm 38, going on 39 this year, and it's, I am coming up to that midlife bit. And I'm wondering, did that shift happen for you at midlife?
I was probably a little later. That's probably that horrible ambition that I talked about earlier. It took me a little longer.
How did C-suite feel?
That was tough. Again, right place, right time, or wrong place, right time, I'm not sure, depending on how you look at it. But effectively, being in the business for quite a long time, we were a listed company, we delisted, privatized, and the new owner shifted and lifted an existing board of one of the business units within the business. So he effectively made them the new board. There was three of them. And then I was added on. I was kind of the old, only person from the old guard that kind of survived and was added in. So the reason I say it was tough is that they had a way of working together. They knew their roles, their strengths, their weaknesses. And I was trying to find my fit with all of that. And I think that is often a thing as you climb up the ladder, you know, you have to be really massively emotionally intelligent and adaptable. I'm not saying that I am those things, but I think it's very important that you try. And I found the first year exhausting, absolutely exhausting, because it was like being the new kid at school and there was an established gang of friends that you had to join. You know, there was no choice. If it was going to work and you were going to fit in, you had to join it. So now it did work and we ended up calling ourselves the Fab Four. And funnily enough, before this call, I was finding a restaurant for us to have another reunion dinner in a month's time, you know, so there's a kind of happy ending to that story. But C-suite was tough, and it was tough because we had a change of ownership model and I very quickly was having to do new things. I was having to get a lot more friendly with an Excel spreadsheet and finances and all the things that come with being a board member that you are legally responsible for. You know? That's so you do feel a huge change, and you can't just stay in your lane. You are responsible for everything in lesser, in different volumes. You know, I'm never going to be as responsible as the CFO for the balance sheet, but you still have legal responsibility and you have to understand how these things work. So it was my last big university of life, of work, kind of period of my career. So tough, really tough, that transition.
So as you mentioned, you were also in a great position to have influence over the organization when you were sitting in that role. And you mentioned culture being an important aspect of what you did. When you look back on that, what do you think your real successes were in terms of influencing the culture of ISG? And how does it compare to other similar organizations at that time?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's probably two aspects to it. One bit is your personal brand, because once you have got that title, this is going to sound horribly conceited, but people are generally really nice to you. They want to talk to you in the lift. They want to know what's going on. They know that you know things that will be interesting about the company, you know, about whether it's the strategic direction, the next awards you're up for, or the next big project won, or whatever it might be. So people stop you in the corridor or as you walk the floor, as you're getting from your desk to a meeting room, people want to stop, they want to talk. They never so much wanted to do that with me before, you know, and I really noticed that. So I thought, this is incredibly important in terms of culture. The way I am in these interactions is incredibly important. It wasn't massively calculated, because I sort of said at the beginning, I believe in kindness and, you know, I like people. And I know that's a strange thing to say, but I like being around people. I like having good conversations with people. As a C-suite, you suddenly have a massive role to set in culture. And I think that changes the organization, how people interact with clients, how people interact with each other, all of that. It's kind of like sets a tone, you know. And I think all of us at that time, there'd been glass offices, all of that kind of stuff. I even had one, and an executive assistant that sat out front that stopped anyone getting into the glass office, and all of that. That all changed. They all came down. We sat on the same size desks as everybody else in an open office. Anyone could come up to us, talk to us at any time. So there are things you can do that set culture. And then there is the more formal stuff around vision, values, all of that stuff, and how you set those. And we've got a chance to reset all of that. And then it's how you embed that, how you celebrate the people that are living that culture, so that there's a kind of, everyone is aspiring to be a living embodiment of those values and that culture. Then I guess there's a third element, because I've always said you almost can't write culture down. You just feel it, you know? And when people used to ask me, what is the culture? I always used to say brave, entrepreneurial, informal, can-do, friendly, celebratory, that all of those kind of words. And they're not in the values, but they are what comes out of the values. And I felt I led that through the way I conducted myself, and I led it because probably it was my responsibility more than anybody else's to make sure the culture was felt by the people that joined and stayed with the business, and even those that left the business where possible. You know,
important in global and yet full transparency. I worked with you at ISG. That's how this whole thing's come about. And I was lucky enough to be a part of that privatization, new brand launch, and making it was personalizing the board. Yes, they're real people, but boards are historically in glass boxes, untouchable, unaccessible. And we went through that shift of personalizing these real life people, making them accessible. And this morning, I was just watching a video of the CEO of Novartis of how he's doing that. But he's, you know, talking about family and experience to personalize the people that are at the helm of these huge brands, because it has to come from top down to be felt from the bottom up.
Yeah. And I always felt, and I started this podcast out with the word kindness, I always felt that you can have one of those roles, but still have that as the most important thing to you. Being kind and a relatively sensitive individual never stopped me from achieving. And I think it's always a mistake when someone thinks they've almost got to be a tough, sometimes not a terribly nice person to reach the top. Because I still believe clients, employees like working with nice people who are kind and come from a good place. And I think, it worked for me.
Mm. It may be business to business, but at the end of the day, it's people to people. That was takeaway.
So shifting gears slightly, ISG went through a fairly high profile collapse in 2024, went into administration in September. You were close to that. How did that feel for you, particularly given what you'd built up to that point? And what is your relationship with it now that you've had a few months of reflection?
Yeah. It felt horrible. That would be the answer. It was horrible. And it was horrible for all 3,000 people. There's no other word to describe it. You know, the stress was off the scale. You're doing everything in your power to not make that the outcome. And it was the worst thing that's ever happened in my career. Not the worst thing that's ever happened to me personally, but the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my career. So that was beyond tough. And it's in relatively, it's still in the rearview mirror very much. You know, it's still, and I think about what everyone went through. In terms of how I feel about it now, I believe, I hope that most people would think I did everything I could do to not make that the outcome. And I think what you can do is, as you see people move on, and the vast majority of ISG people I know have found other employment, I celebrate that. I celebrate that on LinkedIn, because that is a joy that I feel that has come out of this situation, that the talented people that loved working at the company and loved the culture have gone on, and hopefully they will take some of that with them and improve other organizations. And I think you have to look at it that way. Of course, you also think of the other companies affected and the clients affected, particularly though the subcontractor community and what any, and we've seen a lot of construction failures, haven't we? You know, you don't go too far back to Carillion, which was a much bigger company. It's another university moment. I've learned so much, you know, it's so much that I never wanted to learn. I take no pleasure from that.
You mentioned an earlier point in your career where you took refuge in work when you had difficulty in your personal life. What was it like during those years at ISG towards the end when it was extremely stressful at work? Were you able to find that refuge in your personal life? Were you able to manage that stress effectively?
Well, it's very interesting, Alice, because I had planned to retire 2.5 years earlier. I mentioned, you know, that I had a health blip, I had a stroke in my early 50s, and I kind of went part-time. So I came back part-time. So I've been working part-time for about 2.5 years, but still on the board. And then we had some changes. There was a new CEO, and so I sort of agreed to stay on for longer than I'd planned to. So in terms of refuge, you know, I joined a gym. I did all of the things that you should do. I started swimming. I was doing 40 lengths every other morning, and, you know, and I started doing all those things. And then when something like this happens, you can't work part-time when you know something is happening. So for the last sort of 6 months, I was full-time. And if I'm being brutally honest, there's no refuge.
Right.
I was in that period, it was between dogs. I think a dog helped at that time, but my previous dog was sadly passed on. And the new dog I talked about earlier, I hadn't got yet because I was waiting to retire to get that dog. Something like a dog walk or even stroking a dog, coming home to a dog that is just elated is a great way of at least temporarily forgetting about work, isn't it? You know, it's just
absolutely.
They don't understand. So I don't think I had any refuge, you know, and you know, the thing you have to not do is find refuge in a wine glass, of course, you know. So I managed to stay physically healthy, but mentally you don't stop thinking about, you know, you might lose yourself in 20 minutes of a movie, but for the other hour and a half, you're probably not with it and stewing, you know? So sadly, there was no work-life balance at all. And I would defy, I'm thinking about my colleagues, you know, and at the time and coming in every morning and just the haunted looks on everyone's faces, you know, because it's tough. It's very tough.
It's a real trauma, isn't it?
It is. It is. And like I say, I feel for all of the stakeholders affected, but I take great comfort. I'm still in touch with hundreds of ISG people, hundreds. And people still phone me for career advice. I was in Ibiza not so long back and, you know, was taking a call on a beach from somebody who'd started a new job and felt it wasn't right for her and had another offer and didn't know where to go. So you can do things like that to help you recover. You can continue to be helpful to those people that have had a rough time. And things like that help your recovery. You know, when you find joy in someone actually making good out of bad.
So where are you today then? You've had a few months since that all happened. You have now potentially achieved this runway towards retirement that you've been looking for a few years. What are you doing now? And what's next?
Yeah. So right now I'm doing some consultancy work. I've been lucky enough that some of the people who are old contacts who have moved on to do different things have approached me to help with a few bits, some of which I've said yes to, some of which I haven't. The initial thing was a kind of when I initially found myself not gainfully employed and sort of and retired effectively, I had all these grand ideas. I've got an idea for a novel in me. I was going to go back to art class and, you know, and do things like that. I did start the novel, didn't do any drawing or painting, and I did quite a lot of sitting around, which is really, and I got a puppy, which you know, so I felt dissatisfied, and I felt like I'm not sure this is for me, and I had half my friends and family saying, just stop, can we see you more than once a quarter? And can you actually be present in the room? And you make that your job. And I had other people who I felt quite resentful to saying, you can't stop yet. You'll drive yourself mad. And so I think my brain was telling me to just stop, but my heart wasn't in my retirement. So I think what I need to achieve is a kind of segue. I need a ramp into it. So what I'm doing now is I'm doing some consultancy work, and I'm working with three other people in a business that is being incubated by an investor. So it's not launched, and it might never be launched. But we're doing some proof of concept type stuff, which is going really well. I've got a couple of consultancy pieces, one of which is a fairly significant rebrand that I might take on. It's going to be a big old piece of work. And I'm sure that both of you find, because this is new for me, I've never been a freelance consultant, sole trader type individual before. It's already feeling like you're all in or you're not, because, or you have to, you're either in a state of panic that you've not, or you're absolutely overloaded because you've said yes to everything. So I'm at the top of the ramp. That's where I am, Alex, right now, kind of looking to slow down. I haven't got a date in mind for when when work ends altogether. And I qualified, it's funny, about being adapts on learning. I keep saying that it's a big school day or another day at university. About 2 years ago, I did the Henley Executive Coaching, took a master's, then it's not a master's, but a certificate or whatever it's called. And I'm not sure I'm a coach, but I think I could be a mentor. And I have met people, and I've got people that there are still people, whether it's formal mentoring, but people I speak to around the world, that still say, can I bend your ear for half? That's the stuff I find really fulfilling. It's the stuff I love to do. So I think I'll probably always do that as long as someone wants me to. If people ask, the answer is pretty much always yes, unless I didn't like their personal values. So I'll be doing that forever, I think, but probably not getting paid for it. Just being a people pleaser, like I said earlier.
Right. Well, wonderful, Richard. This has been a really interesting conversation. We really appreciate you joining us and chatting with us about your career. I assume at the moment you haven't got anything to share in terms of new company or anything like that, but people can get in touch with you on LinkedIn if they have questions.
It would still be the best way. I've done the classic thing of coming out full-time employment and using the word consultant as a job title, which everyone does, whether they are consulting or not. But I am, and people can reach me through LinkedIn. You're right, Alice.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you so much. This has been a really valuable and insightful conversation, and we just really appreciate your time.
We do. Thank
pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any Work is Weird moments to share, please find us on LinkedIn and let us know what they were. In the meantime, have a wonderfully weird week, and we